You are listening to Radio Albion.
Hello everyone, welcome to another edition of the Orthodox Nationalists. This is Matthew Raphael Johnson, as always, and today is the 2nd of November, 2022. I've been away for the past week, something I absolutely needed to do, especially after my book was released, which was a tremendous amount of work. Many of you have bought it, I really appreciate that. Supporting me however you can. I've just been informed that another book criticizing nominalism was released 2 days after mine. One of the reasons that I released the book when I did is that I knew, since I'm so well known for it, that it's just a matter of time before someone else takes the same or similar position. And I wanted to get the book out before anyone else did. I don't know who this author is, if he's been influenced by me. It's hard to believe he wasn't. But the fact that it was 48 hours after I published mine is interesting. So I appreciate all your support in that regard, because I deal with the church fathers as metaphysicians. My book will always, stand pretty much alone. I want to note, too, that this other book has the word ontology in the title. So it kind of makes sense, but I'm very happy I released the book when I did, The Ontology of Death, which you can find on Amazon. Some of you remember going way back to when I first started this, that the medieval world was and is an essential part of what I do, simply based on the theory that I started developing in college, that the Middle Ages were a superior time to be alive for a whole bunch of reasons. Now, it's very unfair to go to anyone like me, born in 1971, and saying, well, you wouldn't be happy back then. Well, that's probably true, since, again, I was born in 1971. That means you're raised with a certain number of expectations. So the comparison would be someone born in 1271 versus someone born in 1971. Very different set of expectations. And understanding medieval institutions and the thought that undergirds them is extremely important. The book prior to this one is on medieval metaphysics and medieval political thinking, also available on Amazon. The true sign of an amateur historian or theorist of any kind is the belief that every society in the past thinks like this one. And if a priority in 2022 is not reached in 1022, so much worse for the older society. But the means of thinking, the nature of the cognition and the assumptions, the view of the world that existed in the Middle Ages has almost nothing in common with this one, for better or for worse. And that explains where the nominalism book came from. Nominalism is not just the ultimate sin, the original sin that came at the death of the Middle Ages and created the modern world, cognitively speaking. But it also is a key component in explaining how different the two modes of thought were and are. to understand how a medieval thought, you can't start with modern assumptions. And that's, scholars of, you know, in academia have been making this error for a long time. You have to understand what's at the root of how a medieval person, many educated medieval men, thought of the world. And to break the bonds of nominalism, the Lockean point of view, it's really hard to do for those of us born in this era, since we were raised assuming this is true. Breaking out of that is very difficult. But unless you break out of it, you can't understand the Middle Ages. And this is why so many modern scholars fail completely. So, in the talk we're going to have today, we're going to talk about a very important medieval institution in the pre-Orthodox and the Orthodox world in Eastern Europe, and that is a druzhina. That's the primary state-building body of early medieval Kievan Rus. And if we have time, how that manifests itself in the reign of St. Olga. I've never dealt with St. Olga on this show, or really at any other time. In my first book, I mentioned her for a while, but not in any detail. And I think that's a mistake that I'm hopefully going to rectify either this week or next week. But just like nominalism precludes someone from understanding the Middle Ages, the druzhina is an institution that has to be understood in every respect before you can make sense out of the Kievan Middle Ages. Today, of course, everyone and their mother is talking about Ukraine as if they know something, and it's terribly embarrassing. But the military ethos, really the state-building ethos of the time, prior to the so-called Mongol invasion, was this body, the druzhina, which derives, I think most of you know, from the Slavic word drug, or friend, companion. And over time, that came to mean a very specific kind of brotherhood, largely a military one. And it was a necessity for many reasons. The early Kievan state stood against, at one time or another, the Byzantines, the Northerners, the Crusaders, and then later the invaders, what we call Mongols. Something that Lev Gumilev, many others, have explained in great detail is that one of the things that define the East Slavic world is this constant confrontation between the vast plains of the steppe on the one hand and the northern forests on the other. Nations are built by many variables. One of them is topography. The steppe, or the plains, in Eurasia are enormous and make controlling this area extremely difficult. And a key component of the Eurasianist idea is that this steppe, very difficult to control, especially at the time, is the key to controlling not just the Russian areas, but Central Asia, and even the Far East as well. But the steppe, prior to the consolidation of Kiev, hosted numerous tribes, all on horseback, because this is a huge area. Not many places to hide, and sometimes not a whole lot of water. The Sarmatians, many others, many nomads that were forced into some other form of lifestyle, the sedentary lifestyle, because nomads are largely parasitic. And as the Slavs split into the famous three groups and consolidated themselves roughly around the 7th century, the hilltop city, or the hilltop fortress, became one of the key Slavic, and really one of the key Aryan institutions for controlling an area that's very difficult to control. And the hilltop city is how a local prince can control a large area. But this was always held very trepidatiously. The major rivers, of course, were equally significant and trade both with the Greeks to the south and the Scandinavians to the north, helped define this group of people. Rivers moving north to south regularly. And the Rus, to a great extent, came from this set of arrangements, at least as far as topography is concerned. The consolidation of the Eastern Slavs came through the institution of the Druzhina, or the war band, the companions of the prince, the bodyguard, and at most the elite horsemen of the great cities of the East. The Druzhina was not a feudal institution. In other words, there was no contract involved. It was strictly interpersonal. It wasn't based on heredity. It wasn't based on fulfilling a certain very specific spelled out role that a contract would imply. A member of this group could leave at will, could and then could be brought in if they were good enough, if they were smart enough. This was how the state was built. And as the years have gone by, I've come to realize that this is really a core principle of East Slavic political theory, at least in Middle Ages. The prince was obligated, though, for the most part, to arm them and house them at his own expense. And they were, for the most part, expected to be fanatically loyal, and overwhelmingly, they were. This was the bodyguard. I don't want to go so far as to say, you know, the Praetorian system. I'm not saying this, but at least there were some very primitive parallels to it. They were used not just as the core of the military, not just as bodyguards, but they were used as enforcers. And one of the key elements that I want to mention is that without strong institutions, the only force you really had was the personality of the prince, and that personality was based on military prowess and translating that into works of justice. Without institutions, you needed to rely on your own personality, and the Druzhina was a way that that personality could be manifest. The problem with that is if a strong prince dies and there's a debated or uncertain succession, the state goes into chaos. That's not the case with strong institutions, but essentially comes down to a bureaucracy. The Druzhina was the much older alternative to bureaucracy. Later on in Russian history, it was the noble family. The other thing, too, is that this system, this bodyguard, this Druzhina, the sworn companions, is the origin of Russian nobility. Now, it's true they came from elsewhere, especially the Grand Duchy of Lithuania, even parts of eastern Poland, but the origin of the true Kievan nobility, and then later on, derives from this group of people and derives from this this mentality. The Rus principalities came into their own in the 10th century. And by the 11th, the creation of an early form of state, and I use that word very loosely, because of course modern assumptions of what government is and medieval assumptions are, you know, very different things. Especially when you don't have a reliance on institutions, and really, in many ways, have a distrust of institutions. There are alternatives to bureaucracy. Noble families and things like the Druzhina were the alternatives to what later became the state, or this collection of bureaucratic offices. So as Kiev consolidated into a functioning state, it's not never became an empire because it was very ethnic. And there's actually textual proof of that. Centrally ethnic. I mean, these were Eastern Slavs, which is why there was no real contract. They spoke the same language, they maintained the same customs, and a bit later maintained the same religious outlook. That was not the case in the time of consolidation. I don't like using the word pagan because it doesn't mean much. There's no summary of pagan beliefs. It doesn't exist. There's no pagan creed. There's no pagan heretics. There's no pagan councils. You know, it's just every form of poetic culture prior to orthodoxy. So it's a very vague term. And it's said, you know, neutrally. It's not a pejorative. Because so many of them respected the Orthodox Church because of the power of the Byzantine, the power of the Byzantine Empire, which everyone was quite envious of. And we talked about that a few weeks ago at length. Even the throne room and everything we talked about 2 weeks ago about the Byzantine Empire, this, despite having a, you know, today would be a very small bureaucracy, this kind of means of shock and awe impressing visitors, this also was another alternative to a bureaucratic state. Compared to 2022, the Middle Ages were pure anarchy. By comparison, their bureaucracy was minuscule by comparison. Things were regulated via ritual and liturgy, not by the bureaucratic power structure and pecking order. But as the state consolidated, the Druzhina became the core of civil administration. And this is really what political science and history is all about in this sense. How do you go from a quote-unquote tribal world to some variation of a settled state? And the Druzhina is one of these intermediate institutions. And they developed two layers of it. The top, the noble boyar, the true aristocracy, and then underneath it, the junior members, and this would include low-level nobles, and what we would call commoners, who were promoted due to their ability. In the Middle Ages, heredity was a very iffy principle, because you didn't see it very much in Rome. You didn't see it elsewhere. It developed only in certain places as a matter of convenience and training, more than some ideological. You know, Russia ended up perfecting it, but centuries later. It isn't, you know, the Russian laws eventually enshrined it, but prior to that, prior to the modern era, talent had everything to do. And these nobles, I say upper and lower nobles, there were no strict, you had the same thing in Byzantium. You had titles, but that didn't imply a corporate body with a corporate identity. Especially in Eastern Europe, where in the Kievan state, they were all Slavic-speaking peoples. This was simply a matter of practicality. Greater nobles versus lesser nobles had to do with their military experience, their reputation, their family, etc. It doesn't imply an actual strict corporate power structure based on, you know, office holding. And they, you know, they were the best armed forces. They're a mix of the Northern or Scandinavian, Slavic, and even the more semi-Turkish steppe. When you think of the steppe, you think where the Cossacks came into existence with a lot of southern, you know, using the curved sword, small, very fast horses, ambush techniques, guerrilla warfare, that's associated with the southern steppe region. With the collapse of Khazaria, those who fled the area, especially skilled labor, and many of them were Orthodox, many of them weren't anything, came into the service of the Kievan princes, for better or for worse. As relations with Byzantium developed, especially during the reign of the great Saint Olga, Byzantium provided a stricter political point of view. And in both cases, skilled craftsmen came into the area. And this is how states come to be built, but you still have a lack of uniformity. The Druzhina, depending on the prince, depending on his attitude, his success, his failure, the nature of the topography, the economy, whether the economy was monetized or not, their connection to a local river or lake, especially one that dumps out into the Black Sea. These are all just the very basic variables that came into you know, discussing what kind of state was built and what kind of Druzhina existed. Initially, of course, were very lightly armored. Officers, the highest level, especially in the southern areas, started to use mail and plate, which was imported from Byzantium. Even the helmet has both the Scandinavian form, but the pointed top suggests a southern steppe origin. So the notion of the Eastern Slavic peoples with this Slavic linguistic core did borrow many elements from the south and the north, and certainly from Byzantium, and I don't want to give short shrift to the Bulgars either. The spear was the basic weapon, but they used both the northern longsword and the Byzantine shortsword, depending on their location. The axe, the flail, but you know, in terms of the swords, the curved ones are from the steppe, and of course the long and short, as I've mentioned, and the use and development of the compound bow, and a bit later, some variation of the crossbow. In the steppe region, of course, very difficult to control. Huge areas, not a whole lot of places to hide, very flat, very arid. Fast horses were essential. But they always were relatively small in size. They were organized on the decimal system. Again, also a southern feature. The Sotki was a commander of 100, which is where we get the word 100 or black 100 from, and the Salski, or the commander of 1,000, the Voivod, is the commander of an army, which on average was about 2,500 to 5,000 men. You didn't have the mass armies that the modern era. And I know that there's a lot of exaggeration in terms of numbers. And the army as a whole had the Druzhina at its core. And then the local tribal militias that were mustered by the nobility, and then later foreign auxiliaries, especially from the south, the Pechenegs, who were Turkic, and even the Drevelians, who were East Slav. Policing, hunting served as their training, and in the primary chronicle, which I have, like any scholar of old Russia has a problem with the primary chronicle, which is supposed to be the core source for early medieval Slavic history, from the the lay of Igor, as well as the non-fictive descriptions of Igor's forces. Spear in the Norseman helmet, as well as the tremendous knowledge of the specific area, is what made them what they were. They were part of the main shield wall, but of course they couldn't be the entire thing. They were the links that held it together, so to speak. They were always on horse, especially in the steppe, and they were used for flankers. In fact, they used the eastern or the far eastern shower of arrows technique in many cases, and they could do all of it. They were, I don't want to use the phrase special forces, but it kind of makes some sense here, in that they could do any aspect of combat, mounted or otherwise, the weaponry, as well as strategy and artillery, all are in their realm of competence. And this is ultimately what created the Eastern Slavic nation. Not that it derived from the Druzhina, but this was the core of the combat forces. And in the constant fighting and the various neighbors, hostile neighbors, sometimes hostile, sometimes not, this is where the idea of a specific nation comes into existence. The nation is founded in struggle, just like the individual is. When one prince was defeated, because this is all one ethnic group, they would join the victorious prince, and it would create this snowball effect. And ultimately, this is where the major cities and the what succeeded the hilltop fortresses. This was the core of this development. And this is how large armies were built at the time. So, given that we're dealing with large areas, physically large areas, either the flat steppes or the very difficult forest terrain, this Drusino was always in motion. This is how, almost in a liturgical sense, I mean, this is sort of what a procession is. A procession, as we talked about with the Byzantine court, was a way to manifest the order and justice of a specific area. This is why they were always in motion. In the early medieval West, royal courts were always on the move. You couldn't have a fixed capital without our contemporary modes of transport. It took a long time to get to the capital, so the capital came to you. In this case, the Drusina took this role, and they were always moving. And this developed, according to the Primary Chronicle, there's some problems with this, but it moved from north to south, from Novgorod to Kiev itself. The movement from Smolensk to Lublin, which of course was the core of the Polish Lithuanian state later, and then to Kiev. And this is what Oleg, who came after Rurik, again, I'm not necessarily endorsing this very simple approach, but this is the idea, moved south, and the point was to control lands along the Dnieper, the most strategic waterway of the era. And the Primary Chronicle says that the Drusina of Oleg reached Kiev, enriching itself in the process, asked, of course, this was the Axel and Deer era in Kiev, and asked them to come out. And the Primary Chronicle says precisely, not to fear, because we are of one race. Race in the sense of genetic inheritance. Unfortunately, that was just a ruse, and the two were jumped and killed. But even if the story is not precisely the case, it's just a dressing up of what actually happened. It's not invented. That's the problem with some of these stories. They're not concocted. They're mythical in the true sense. They're true in essence, fanciful in detail. So Igor gave way to St. Olga and then to Svatoslav as one succession. And as this developed, of course, you had the Scandinavians to the north, Poland to the west, Bulgars to the south, and as I mentioned earlier, at the end of their empire, the Khazars, to the southeast, holding both to the Black and the Aral Seas. But they did more than this. Regardless of the truth of the Axel and Deer story, it really doesn't matter, because in essence, that is what happened, maybe not with that detail. But they also served, and this can't be stressed too much, they were the escorts for the ship and caravan convoys with this massive income that they received from the Byzantine Empire. Anything the Byzantine Empire touched became enriched as a result. There was no comparison between the northern culture and that of Constantinople. But even in the era of the civil wars, prior to St. Yaroslav, the Drusina was at the center of all of these developments. When you talk about a prince, and historians have a tendency to personalize power, like we talked about before, the prince was the first among equals within the Drusina system. The prince couldn't function without his core brotherhood. They functioned largely as a unit. Again, I don't want to imply this level of uniformity, but for the most part, it developed that way. Yaroslav's army was about 40,000 against his brother Svatopolk. Mixed forces with auxiliaries from the Turkic regions. This was common. And that his battle, that this battle for Kiev went on for months. Allegedly, this battle had tremendously high casualties, and Svatopolk fled as a result. Svatopolk then went to the Pechenegs. This was not a Slavic tribe, and attacked again, and he finally fled. The core of all of this activity, though, is the Druzhina, and if you lost too many of them, it didn't matter what else you had in terms of your military apparatus. It was a baptism of what we might call paganism until Vladimir the Great. We're going to talk about St. Olga here in a second as one of the reasons that they converted en masse. But the constant combat, and not just in Yaroslav's era, between the southern tribes, sometimes Byzantium, Poles, and the Bulgars on the Volga, not only created this combat, this militaristic consolidation, which then, developed into a very articulate idea of the nation, not just the state, but the wealth from these trading and plundering missions. These Diep tribes and the battle against them made the Kievan nation. And this was the height of Kievan Rus. But civil war, as many of you know, as I've talked about before, began to sap the strength of the state. The Conference of Princes in 1097 was a failure. The fragmentation, and I've dealt with this elsewhere, developed throughout the 12th century, and this led to the what some call the Mongol invasion. I've made the claim, and most Russians will agree with me, that the Mongols were not Asiatics from Far East Asia. At least not in the what we would call the High Middle Ages. But regardless, it was the fragmentation of the Kievan state, the instability of the urban-centered system that led to the fall of that civilization. Now, with that background, I want to apply this to the great St. Olga, the regent of the Kievan state, in the 10th century. This is St. Vladimir's grandmother. And it's my contention, I think most would agree with me, that the conversion of St. Vladimir the Great could not have occurred without the reforms, the popularity, and the orthodoxy of St. Olga. Now, she was married initially to Igor, the son of the Rurikid line. Oleg eventually took over because the heir was simply too young and spread the boundaries of the empire tremendously. 912, Oleg died, and Igor and his wife Olga took over. Now, what's significant here is that this is an era of tremendous growth and consolidation of the Kievan state. The key event, though, concerns the Dravilians, which is a Eastern Slavic tribe, which had been, eventually was defeated and mixed with the rest. After the death of Oleg, a very early prince, they stopped paying tribute and worrying about what the succession was going to be. You had, the heir was simply too young. By 945, Igor finally went after the Dravilian capital and very quickly surrendered. They agreed to reinstate the tribute, but it was very small. They were testing, seeing what kind of state was developing here after Oleg's death. He then asked for the full amount, and this is when resistance began. Igor himself, who was always on campaign, including to Byzantium, and his Druzhina, most of it, they were captured while they were essentially acting as envoys to the Dravilian capital, and they were murdered. In fact, the primary chronicle says that he was torn between two tied-down birch trees. And that actually is not just from the primary chronicle, that also comes from Byzantine sources too. So now Olga is a widow. The year Svyatoslav was 3 years old. That means that Olga then was the regent for Svyatoslav. But the Drevelians thought that they can get away with this because here you have a woman, you don't really, you have a regent here and a baby. And the way they perceived it, they perceived chaos in Kiev. The Drevelians sought to expand. This could have been a Drevelian state rather than what we know today as the Kievan state. So they sent envoys to Kiev. The leader was Prince Mal, and he had a marriage proposal. And this way, through marriage, not through conquest, he was going to be the leader and the ruler of all of Kiev, and having his Drevelian base as the as his core. She pretended. Now, she knew, of course, her husband had been tortured to death. But you're talking about one of the great leaders of the Middle Ages, and Olga acted very calmly, pretending that none of this really bothered her, and agreed. Now, of course, this simply wasn't going to happen. Because of her position, she had to tread very carefully. She told Mal's, essentially his Druzhina, that I'll be ready for you tomorrow. Your people, you know, in the old northern tradition, carry your boat with you, raise it over you, we will honor you, and we'll begin the process of connecting the two states. But rather than the banquet, the Mal's Druzhina comes in, and she had a pit dug for them. The people of the city, who were supposed to be there to praise them and cheer, and served as the human wave that then shoved them right into this pit, and then the population took rocks and dirt and buried them alive. Because the heir was 3 years old, because Olga was only a regent, they thought they can get away with anything. Mal was extremely overconfident. Olga came to the rim of the pit and asked if they were pleased with their treatment as they were being buried alive. And strategic outlook would serve her in the future too. She then sent an embassy to the Drevelians, agreeing to a wedding. Remember, things moved very slowly back then. The fact that this Drevelian had been buried alive, that news hadn't come back yet. You know, quite knew where they were. It wasn't an issue of concern. But they certainly knew about the wedding proposal. And she came with a very small escort. Her Drevelian was very tiny, which of course she did on purpose. The Drevelians began wondering why they haven't heard from their envoys, but because she shows up with such a small Drevelian, there's no real threat here. And they didn't really know her that well, and really considered that there was only a young child who was the heir, so they weren't threatened in the least. She offered them, now while she was going to head to the Drevelian capital, when her alleged wedding banquet, the wedding banquet, it was the celebration of the betrothal banquet, she offered them a bath. And when the rest of the Druzhina went into the bath, she locked the door and burnt the place down. So now you have two groups of Mal's Druzhina that has any envoys who have been killed. One's from one buried alive and the other now burnt in the bath. That was at that point, of course, that she made her pilgrimage to the Drevelian capital. So you have two groups of Mal's Druzhina now killed, And she, with a small retinue, as I said, heads down to their capital. As I said, they were overconfident. They saw her small retinue and were not threatened. At the banquet for the betrothal, the remaining nobility got very drunk, and the small group of Drusina that she had came in and slaughtered them in the middle of the night. They were not in the least bit threatened by Olga. They were not threatened by the handful of men, but the men who she did bring were extraordinary, the best of the best. She slaughtered the cream of their nobility. Now, there are three incidents where she used deceit. We see this in the Old Testament, too, where she used deceit to destroy her opponent. She suffered zero casualties at this point, while now the cream of the nobility in these three incidents have been destroyed. Then, of course, now the pretense is gone. She went back to Kiev and raised an army, and she destroyed the capital. The cities had surrendered to her fairly quickly, and she and her the what, of course, now this is a more famous story from the Primary Chronicle, which rings true to me for a bunch of reasons. And she offered a very, very small tribute. And the tribute was, I want a dove and a sparrow from each household in the empire. And they were quite pleased with that. They were convinced that she just wanted trade relations, that, she'll stop the killings. She doesn't want, you know, she has her revenge for the murder of her husband. But here was yet now a fourth incident of trickery. Three pigeon sparrows actually was the amount for each household. Her men took this tribute. Each soldier got a bird, and there was a thread attached to each one. There was a sulfur compound that was encased in linen. Now, when this was lit, they were let go. And of course, where are they going to go? They're going to go to the buildings and the homes where they always had their nests. This came from the household. They were always building in the eaves. And so when they went home, the nest went up. And that means the house went up. The entire, the capital city was burned. Even the outlying areas were burnt to the ground. Now, this is how she consolidated power. This was far more than just revenge for her murdered husband. This was the completion of his mission to expand the borders of the empire south. So you have three elements where she actually took a position of weakness, and because of the overconfidence of her enemies, turned it into a position of power. She was one of the most popular rulers of her era. This kind of thing, even if, you know, details may be off on some of these things, clearly she, and no one disagrees, that she used tremendous deceit and trickery to destroy the Drevalian Empire, and they never quite recovered from this. But she did afterwards, as regent, solidified the realm. She fortified the borders, and she created an innovation called the Pogosti. One of the most important innovations of her, of Kievan Rus, and it was used ever since then. These were administrative centers located in every populated area, especially in the cities. This was the first step at institutionalizing political power, rather than simply her personal presence, which of course was powerful enough. But how is that personal presence going to be regularized? This is what the Pogosti were. This was the first step towards some version of real statehood. Even the tribute system, not the bird version, but an actual tribute system, turned into a regular taxing system. The Pogosti was not just a manifestation of state power. going from one place to another. This was like a procession. It was meant to consolidate, psychologically speaking, the border. And the border being the border between order and disorder, as the Romans and later the medieval mind always understood a border to be. Borders were sacred. Even in the pagan mind, the border markers, in fact, had personalities granted to them. The border markers were extremely important. It wasn't just the division of one place to another. It was a division between good and chaos. Not good and evil, but good and chaos. Between justice and death. You know, the old folk tales about going into the forest. The forest is the realm beyond the borders. And God knows what's waiting in there for you. That's how they viewed the life beyond the civilized borders. There can be no justice on the other side. Because there is no state, there is no order, and really there is no reason. It's almost a subconscious coming to life. To this day, the forest has this hideous, horror-centric presence to us. That has not gone away. It's simply part of human nature. So it wasn't merely the consolidation of the state, but the consolidation of the border. And the Pogosti were essential to all of this. The Pogosti network permitted a very orderly trip from Kiev to Byzantium. And each step of the way, there was a small tax. So this means Kiev now was reaching their height. And this is what St. Vladimir is eventually going to take advantage of. For the first time, the Eastern Slavs had a regular state system. Again, compared to the modern state, this is anarchy. But for the time, this was the first step towards a rational regularization of political power and hence justice, because that was one and the same thing at the time. And because of this regularization, relations between Byzantium and Rus increased, and the church began to penetrate far beyond what it had been in the past, despite the fact that the Rus was still mostly a non-Christian society. Now, there is one more act of deceit. This one I don't think is completely true. Again, this comes from the Primary Chronicle. Olga wanted to be Orthodox, probably for the same reason that Vladimir did. You had an ethnic unity, but in terms of local culture, you didn't have unity. This was the biggest problem with the pagan system, because from region to region, it differed. And it wasn't a literate system at the time, so this was just a matter of habit. Now, she was a pious woman, but it had the effect of increasing the unity in the state that she needed. Without religious unity, there is no functional state. Whatever the religion might be, when you have two major religions in one state, you rarely have success, certainly in the pre-modern era and even the early modern era, because that's the foundation for morals and assumptions about the world. The assumptions that a Catholic and a Protestant, say in Germany, are going to have, it creates two totally different people. I don't think people appreciate that. She loved Orthodoxy for the same reasons that St. Vladimir did, and the reason that she was canonized. As trade relations grew, exposure to this highly literate, highly complex, philosophically satisfying religious movement grew in Rus. And it was not just Byzantium, but also Bulgaria, where most of the translations, of course, were Slavic and came through Bulgaria, not so much Byzantium. She went to the emperor in person. Now, the emperor, of course, also sought a marriage alliance at the time and to create the Byzantine-Kievan single structure, no different than Prince Mal, though he had a completely different motivation. She didn't want that. She wanted good relations. She didn't want to offend him. So the story goes that she said, "I will only convert if you serve as my godfather." He agreed. The patriarch baptized her, and then she said, "Oh, I can't marry you because this would be incestuous. You are my godfather." Now, that story I don't think is true, only because I highly doubt that an emperor is not going to realize that. Now, what it does say, or that, you know, he wouldn't be advised that this doesn't make any sense. Of course, that aspect probably didn't happen, but it is indicative of a broader respect for Olga. She did convert there. No one denies that. And despite the lack of any marriage, that massively increased the relationship, not just with the Kiev and Byzantium, but Kiev and the Bulgars as well. Now, the Drusina remained for a short time a pagan institution. Now, Svatoslav had come of age, and just like his father, he was always on campaign. So Olga, still a tremendously powerful woman, controlled domestic policy while he was in the field far away. Now, the Byzantines paid Svatoslav, essentially serving as mercenaries, to attack the Bulgars. At the same time, worried that the Rus would simply become too powerful, also paid the Pechenegs to attack Svatoslav from the rear. This is how he got his enemies to fight one another. Now, that is true. The Pechenegs attacked the not just the Svatoslav's men, but also organized an attack on Kiev itself, and in fact, surrounded the city, realizing that the bulk of the army was in the field. The bulk of the army was fighting Bulgaria. Few men. Olga was now in charge of organizing the defense of the city, with very few men at her disposal. Most of her Drusina was over the river, on the other side of the other bank. And of course, a much smaller Drusina, a portion of the Drusina, was there in the city. The Pechenegs knew this. You know, this is a Turkic tribe, unlike the Drevalians, who were Slavic in general. It was a long siege. Food starts to run out. She couldn't get word to her son because they had surrounded the city. Very little was able to get out. As food ran out, finally she located a young boy who spoke the Pechenegs Turkic language. And he was sent to the camp, not seen as a threat. He worked his way across the river and spoke to, delivered a message to her Drusina, which was on the other side. And they were, everyone was fanatically loyal to Olga, so they would do whatever she wanted. Again, deceit. They came to the riverbank and acted much larger than they were. There weren't that many of them, but by making all kinds of noise, rattling swords and shields and everything else, doing everything in their power to make it seem like there was more of them, they intimidated the Pechenek forces. Now, there also was a smaller force within the city itself. The plan, of course, was having both halves of the Drusina to attack the forces surrounding the city at once. Remember, this had been a very long time. The Pechenegs were exhausted. They were constantly being supplied. They wanted to go home. And because of how the retinue across the river made them seem like they made so much noise, they thought that Svatoslav's, the main force, had returned. They attacked the besieging forces all at once. And again, she was victorious. However, of course, the army never returned from Bulgaria. And Olga sent a letter to her son, ripping him a new one, for not responding, not even, by then, there was no question he knew that the city was under siege and still didn't return. And that created a huge rift between the two. Still, once that was done, he did finally return and destroyed what was left of the Pechenig force. St. Olga died roughly about 70 years old. Her years are iffy. But that was the typical lifespan, between 70 and 75. The problem, of course, was infant mortality, but once you pass 2 years old, you live to be 70 or 75. That was the case throughout human history. Now, the reason I bring this up, because St. Olga deserves to be treated on this show, which she hadn't been before. And it makes sense to include her in the warrior ethos of the time. Her brilliance was manifest in her use of deceit. She knew that always, compared to Bulgaria, compared to any foe, she was in a position of weakness. And it comes from the fact that the death of her husband, chaos in the succession, early on, as I mentioned, 912, 915, you had a very young heir. Enemies of Kiev were emboldened by this. You know, women didn't have combat experience. This is one of the reasons they could never really be rulers. You know, to be a ruler, to be the head of a Druzhina unit, you have to be respected by them. You have to have fought in battle. This was the whole point of political power to a great extent, securing the borders. This is why women didn't rule. They weren't warriors. Olga, of course, was well aware of that, understood the differences between men and women, which all sane societies maintain strictly, and said, well, I have something else. I have my brain. No one denied her high intelligence. One of the reasons that she was so popular, not just in Byzantium, but home as well, one of the reasons that she is as important as her grandson, St. Vladimir. By the time she lifted the siege of the city, she was probably the most popular and revered woman in not just in the Slavic world, but certainly in the European world. Why her reputation grew. This is one of the huge reasons that Orthodoxy grew the way it did. And on top of it all, she had regularized, to some extent, the state system. So when it did grow in Kiev and Russia, it was very hard to resist her. This was the woman who defeated enemy after enemy without really shooting a single arrow. She didn't know anything about combat, but she understood the male psyche and knew what would work and what wouldn't. I have no doubt that she used a tremendous amount of flattery in the marriage proposal idea. That she, I've been defeated, I'm this old woman, a poor woman, I should say. Once she dropped the pretense of having nothing bother her at the funeral banquet amongst the Dravilians, as I mentioned, woe was me. There's no threat to these people. Little did they know what she was planning. She used her position of weakness to destroy those who were more powerful. And it's really hard not to think of the scripture's verses, my power is made perfect in weakness. That the weak will overcome the strong. You think of the story of the great Gideon, the judge, with a handful of men destroyed the Midianite Empire. So it's not just that she was a woman of extraordinary justice, that she saved the city over and over again, that she destroyed her enemies without really a whole lot of work, but that she did this while either being sympathetic to or actually becoming a member of the Orthodox Church, the Greco-Bulgarian version that was available to her. And of course she was highly literate, as all members of the family would be. And as always, up until the 20th century, the most pious traditionalist elements of any society were the women, because they were in charge of the family and the hearth and the upbringing. Upbringing, by definition, is the transferring of a way of life from one generation to another, the nature of tradition. Only, of course, in the post-war 20th century did this change, which was an evil, which can never be measured. But St. Vladimir then was able to simply take advantage of this circumstance. St. Olga created the ground for Orthodoxy in Kiev and Rus, and then later Russia. So he needs to be revered constantly. What she was able to do, even lifting the siege with really the only option available to her. Who is this person? But just like Gideon, everyone knew that God had a hand in this. Therefore, how could you possibly resist the God that she worshipped? Even before she went to Byzantium, she was highly sympathetic to the church for the same reason Vladimir was. She was a huge church builder, and the building of churches and monasteries. Her icon always has her with a church in her hand, which is a symbol of the church builder. This also was part of the Pugnosti system. This was how the state was regularized. And in many ways, the churches either worked alongside the administrative centers or supplanted them. So when Vladimir, and again, the Druzhina was always the problem. The warrior elite still had tremendous pagan roots. But with Olga, what were they going to do? This was the god, this was the woman who, from a position of weakness, destroyed all of our enemies while her son was off refusing to come back for whatever reason. It may not have been his fault, but Olga certainly thought it was. How can you possibly resist the god that this woman worshipped? She is a huge reason why Russia, Ukraine, Georgia, etc., Belarus, are Orthodox powers today. She is a root from this. Saint Vladimir then simply took the next step, but he couldn't have done what he did without the massive popularity, veneration of Saint Olga. From a secular point of view, she is the reason why Russia is an Orthodox state today. But the process of state building, Orthodox or otherwise, comes from this sworn brotherhood. Without the brotherhood, without the Druzhina, however you want to interpret that, either from a warrior point of view, a religious sobor point of view, or an economic and state-building point of view, military point of view, however you approach it, this is the core of all Slavic political thinking. This is the root of the sobornos, soborna pravna. It comes from the brotherhood idea that was so important to early modern Ukrainian Orthodoxy. The brotherhood is the sobor, sobornos concept is based on the Druzhina idea. Where faith in spirit, not necessarily a contract, motivates this tremendous loyalty. And it was exemplified by St. Olga and St. Vladimir within to take the next step and to, and there was very little resistance. There was no resistance because of Olga, because no one would dare say a word about her. She could say, you want to stand on your heads for hours, and they would have done it. Not with a personality like that. This is the origin of Rus. Thank you, everyone, for listening, and I will talk to you next time. Bye-bye.